One thing I believed as I began learning about all of those different things was that if it helps people heal, if it helps people find wholeness, if it helps bring people together, I was convinced that there was some kind of a spiritual foundation to it.
Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge. What if you could hang out with high-performing executives, entrepreneurs, and leaders? Ask them about how psychedelics have impacted their self-improvement journeys. Then take an insight or two to guide your own growth. Each week, Alex Atwood takes an in-depth look at how psychedelics can increase fulfillment, solve personal problems affecting your career, and help you gain the success you seek. Alex is an executive and psychedelics coach to high performers, and his goal is to provide strategies to help you reduce conflict, bring awareness, and balance your life through the use of psychedelics. Now, here's Al.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Alchemist Lounge. And today in the lounge, we have an alchemist that I had the pleasure of attending a workshop that he facilitated called Hold Me Tight. Now, Hold Me Tight is some groundbreaking work that's based in the EFT model of therapy for couples. And I attended this. It was a two-day event. I had so much insight, so many breakthroughs, was just really astounded by the way that they presented this material. So I'm so excited to present this with you guys today. And I want to introduce Mark Beck. He's a licensed therapist and he's the co-founder of Pairs Care. And it's a platform that provides couples with virtual counseling and all sorts of coaching services. He has 20 years of experience in the field, and he's helped countless couples overcome their relationship challenges and build stronger, healthier connections. His approach is based in evidence-based practices, and he has a deep understanding of the unique dynamics of romantic relationships. So join us as we delve into the world of couples therapy and explore how Mark's expertise and his very unique journey can help you build a more fulfilling relationship. Mark, thank you so much for coming onto the Alchemist Lounge.
Thank you for having me, Alex. I appreciate it so much. It was a pleasure getting to meet you at our workshop. And I say our, I want to make sure that everyone knows I don't do these workshops alone. My colleague, Vicki Kennedy in Orlando, and I have been doing them for about 4.5 years. And everyone we do is different. And it's the funnest thing I get to do in my work as a therapist. And we just have a ball. So Learning more than I'm teaching every time. And it's great to see the changes that some of these couples go through in just a span of 2 days.
Yeah, it is absolutely miraculous what I saw happen in that room. So let's chat a little bit. Your work in mental health care is incredibly interesting, but I'd love to know more about the person behind the profession. So take me back a little ways. You can start in your childhood or whatever makes sense, and share with me how your upbringing influenced your current path.
Well, I came to the mental health treatment field and my work as a therapist via clergy ministry. I was actually a pastor for about 10 years. Hmm. So I'm originally from Northern Virginia, the DC area, and I was born and raised there. One of those typical middle-class upbringings. I was very fortunate to be raised in a stable home. My parents loved each other. They were married 63 years before my mom passed away in 2014. I have an older sister and a younger brother, and our household was fairly middle class. Most of my social upbringing revolved around our local church. I was raised in a Southern Baptist church in Northern Virginia, relatively conservative, but not fundamentalist, not overly dogmatic. In my college years, I felt what we say in church, a calling to clergy ministry. And so I committed to that and went to seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, on the campus that used to be Wake Forest University, but it was Southeastern Baptist Seminary, and graduated from there in 1984. And I have served three churches. I served three churches over the course of about 10 years and learned something in each one of those. The first one was in North Carolina, and it was a small church. The suburbs of Durham, Chapel Hill, the Research Triangle Park area was just beginning to take root. And a little church I served was not large enough or able to pay full-time staff. And so I learned in that church that I'm not a bivocational pastor. But that's what I did for about a year and a half. I drove a truck during the week and preached on the weekends. And after about a year and a half, then I realized I had spent too much time and effort and energy on a graduate degree to use it one day a week. So we relocated, moved up about an hour north, just across the Virginia state line, to a little country church that served for a year and a half as well. And I learned there that I'm not a country pastor. And those are important lessons to learn. I realized that the expectations and the assumptions for rural ministry were foreign to me. I didn't know the answers. I didn't even know the questions. After about a year and a half, we moved from there. Now, I didn't get run off, wasn't fired or anything, but had a few nicks and bumps along the way. And we eventually relocated to Lynchburg, Virginia, and we stayed there for 7 years. By the end of those 7 years, I had really burned out on ministry. I knew that it was time to make a change. I think three things really facilitated that career change. Two of them were negative. One of them was positive. One negative thing that was going on was happening in my denomination. I am Southern Baptist, or I was at the time, and the Southern Baptist Convention was undergoing a real sociological and theological shift. That was sort of a struggle. I felt like I, as a pastor, I was constantly sort of fighting the current and just didn't fit in the denomination. Now, that's tolerable, and you know, I can survive that. But another process, a negative process, was going on in my life during those years that was much more personal and much more painful. And that was a marriage that was struggling and dying. It was becoming toxic. My ex-wife and I tried the very best we could to hold it together. We had three beautiful kids, all kinds of reasons to try to make that work. And we did the best we could, but it eventually became so obvious that it was toxic. Now, that's painful for any couple to undergo. But for a clergy, it can be terminal to a career. But those two things were extremely stressful to me. And by the end of 6 or so years of my time there in Lynchburg, it was obvious to me that I had just toasted. I did not have the energy and the ability to be there for others. But a third thing that I was going through in those years was very positive. And it simply was that I was growing up and I was becoming more focused on my sense of calling and my skills and my passion in ministry. And I was becoming more and more aware that I felt a real affinity toward pastoral care and specifically counseling, pastoral counseling. I was doing more and more of that. I really felt energized in that arena. So I learned two things over the course of time. I learned, number one, that I really loved counseling. I felt like I could do it, and I felt like I was good at it, but I also learned that I knew just enough to be dangerous, and I either needed to quit doing it or figure out how to do it right. And so all the confluence of those three things really led me to know that I needed to do something more, something different from clergy ministry, and yet all of my experience as a pastor prepared me to be able to make a transition into professional counseling. And so very fortunately, we had a college right there in town, Lynchburg College. It's now the University of Lynchburg, and it offered a program specifically for those who want to become professional counselors and licensed in the state of Virginia. I had the opportunity to do an internship in graduate school that really changed my life. Our local hospital in Lynchburg had a mental health unit where they had what we called mental health consultants in the emergency department. And I did my internship there. It was a 6-month internship. And after it was over, I just stayed and they started paying me. And I did that for 17 years. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic experience because we were working with patients who came into the emergency room in some type of mental health and or substance abuse related crisis. It just really gave me a foundation to use in any other type of mental health circles. During that time, I started a private counseling practice. It was actually based at a local church, and I did that until they closed our department in 2015 and invited us all to find new careers. And that's when I went into full-time private practice and started seeing couples exclusively. So that's what I do now. We moved to Florida in 2017. I've since remarried. God's made it up to me the second time around. I'm a really lucky guy. I've married the best lady in the world, and I do my private practice down here in Central Florida now and see couples almost exclusively. And I met Vicki Kennedy, my colleague, it's been about 6 years ago now, doing some training in emotionally focused therapy. And we've teamed up to do these workshops, and it's the best part of what I do. I just have a blast doing it. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
What a journey, that a road less traveled in so many ways, moving from a pastor and realizing it's just not resonating with who you are. I'm wondering, how did you prepare yourself for that? And being in a position where you're around these people that are coming in with all these sort of different pathologies, and given, you know, you were just kind of thrown into the fire, what did you do to prepare yourself to go day in and day out of that environment?
That's a great question. And it took me a while to settle in and kind of find my legs. And my wife has a wonderful saying. She says at times, fake it till you make it. An emergency room setting, in a crisis setting, professional in the room needs to be able to exude confidence and some kind of a calm demeanor that sends the message, we're going to figure this out, it's going to be okay. And there are times when I'm not sure exactly what I'm seeing or what we're going to do. And it's not about deceiving anybody, but it is about saying, no, we're going to get this done. I don't run too hot. Maybe that's one of my gifts. I try to be a non-anxious presence in the room. And that's the best that I can do at times. And then, you know, you just try to help, try to bring in other resources as necessary. No two cases are the same, but you do need to be aware that oftentimes you are coming alongside people at their very worst moment. A child has suicided. Someone is overdosed. You know, we tried our best to avoid those outcomes, but every now and then the worst happened. And it does take a toll. And so it was important to maintain a good support system, to have a life outside of work. Self-care is very important. I'm not sure how well or poorly I did that, but I stayed till the very end of that department. I loved it. The people with whom I worked are still some of my dearest friends. And it's the best part of my career, at least while I was there. I love what I do now. But I couldn't be where I am right now had I not been through those experiences, both in the ER and clergy ministry, because those have overlapped so many times and in so many ways.
Yeah, and that's actually something I'm very curious about in terms of how your previous experience as a clergy member shaped your initial approach to mental health care.
Before I started my graduate training in mental health, I had done some learning on my own and some reading and so forth, and I was confident of something that indeed was confirmed through to this very day. There's a lot of different modalities and methods of therapy out there. You can find all kinds of different things. There's Rogerian, there's Gestalt, there's solution focused, there's cognitive behavioral therapy. One thing I believed as I began learning about all of those different things was that if it helps people heal, if it helps people find wholeness, if it helps bring people together, I was convinced there was some kind of a spiritual foundation to it, some type of biblical hermeneutic or theme underneath it. And I have found that to be true. I've never found an exception to it. And so what I say is, if it works, I don't care what method you're using, if it works, God got there first. So, you know, Carl Rogers talks about unconditional positive regard, which is how a therapist is supposed to relate to any client. Unconditional positive regard. Dude, that's nothing but grace from Scripture.
Yeah.
That's about compassion and forgiveness and so forth. Solution-focused therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy talk about the power of our thoughts and, you know, how we see the world and the messages we draw from it, positively or negatively. Attachment science says that we all of us crave, seek, we are driven to connection, to a safe emotional connection. And we come from the factory looking for that. And the thing that we've learned is that we all know that infants who don't have a safe attachment figure to protect and nurture and love that infant, that the baby won't develop normally and, in fact, may not even survive. What we've learned over time with attachment science is that we never outgrow that need, because that connection, our bonding, is our safety. In fact, it is survival. It's how human beings have survived and become the apex predators that we are on this earth. And so we're all looking for that safe connection. We all need it. David in the 23rd Psalm said, "For thou art with me, when Jesus' birth was foretold, they said, you'll call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And the last thing Jesus said on earth before he ascended to heaven after his resurrection was, lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. And there's this theme, I don't know what else to call it. I use the word withness. There's this withness of God that runs from one end of Scripture to the other. We were born to connect, to bond, not just with others, but with God. And that's part of what it means to be created in the image of God. And so I've seen that all through my career as clergy. And lo and behold, now here I am in professional counseling circles. And everything I've learned confirms that too. And so I see it as an overlap and a really positive way of understanding these two communities, these two arenas. I don't see any contradiction between psychology and theology. And so I think that sort of is why I say where I am really came through my experience in ministry.
Yeah. And what you're saying, actually, I'm seeing is starting to ring through when you look at theology and science. As we start to look at things like quantum physics and string theory, and we start to look at these sort of relativity, we start to move more into the area of theology. And what I'm seeing is they're sort of intersecting at this point. So it's fascinating time that we're in, is sort of we're going through this evolution of technology and coming back around. When we look on a subatomic level and we look at the energies that are there, it does directly point at what, you know, theologians have been talking about for so many years. And since we're on this topic, I want to dig a little bit deeper. I want to understand, how do you approach the intersection of religion, spirituality, and mental health care in terms of how you practice with your clients and in your workshops? And if you could share some examples of how you've incorporated these as well.
I try to meet people where they are. I don't try to get them to be where I am. Okay. And some people, their faith, their Christian faith is absolutely integral. It's central to them. And so they see the world in terms of faith. And I can understand when somebody says to me, God told me such and such. I mean, I've seen psychiatrists call that hyper-religiosity and a form of psychosis. And it's nothing but understanding we can perceive what is right and a direction to go in terms of God revealing that to us. Now, on the other hand, I also can understand people who come to me and say, I don't want anything to do with God. If you knew how I was raised, the church that I came from, unfortunately, you know, mankind has fingerprints all over religion that obscure what we should be learning about God. And so there's as much healing to do from religion as there is celebrating to do, you know, what positive it's brought us. And I can understand those things too. And, you know, there are times when I just want to say, I'm so sorry that you went through that, because you shouldn't have, and it's not right. And so there's a lot of pathology that comes from shame-based, power-hungry, weaponized, misogynistic, homophobic religion that some people call Christianity. And that leaves a mark, and a lot of people have been scarred by that. So it isn't all good. Now, all that God is good, but religion and God are oftentimes miles apart.
Oh, yeah. And we've seen that metastasize in all sorts of religions, whether it's Islam or Christianity or any of that. I'd like to jump into pairs care, because the couples work that you do and what you've devoted yourself to now is really, in my opinion, sacred work. What inspired you to focus and just put all of your energy now into this sort of work, this couples therapy?
I can remember sort of making that transition. For about 10 years of my private practice, I was working with all kinds of clients, individuals, and I was doing mostly solution-focused therapy, really dove into that. Positive psychology, that's a whole other podcast. But I've always sort of found myself leaning toward doing the hard thing.
And yeah, clearly.
I did not, there just wasn't much out there about good couples work training. I wanted to learn more about that. The more I learned, the more it intrigued me, the more it fascinated me. I've done a lot of training through the Gottman Institute, John Gottman, and Sue Johnson, who is the matriarch of EFT therapy, emotionally focused therapy. They're sort of opposite sides of the same coin. Mm. And so I learned a lot from Gottman, and I just felt like it didn't go deep enough for me. EFT goes deep. It really drills down. And I have drunk the Kool-Aid on EFT. I believe it's where relationships live and heal. And so I felt drawn to working with couples. I won't deny the fact that my experience in a painful, painful first marriage and divorce probably led me in that direction. I hope that with the couples I see, I'm not trying to do my own work. I hope I have better boundaries than that. But I'm also certain that I have a sense of compassion for the pain that couples are experiencing when they're in distress that I couldn't have had if I weren't first married and second divorced.
Yeah.
I'm also grateful enough to know what a healthy relationship feels like. I'm hoping that that, you know, informs my work as well.
Yeah. Well, experience, as they say, is the best teacher.
For sure.
Yeah. Can you describe some approaches that you found to be effective in working with these couples?
Let me do this. I will tell you that emotionally focused therapy is the simplest model and the hardest practice I have ever attempted. On paper, it sounds so very simple until you get in the room and you start doing it, and it can go sideways in so many different ways. But at the end of the day, so let me just talk a little bit about what attachment science says. And I said earlier, we're all of us, even as adults, we seek and we crave a safe emotional connection. And that's how attachment science describes love. Love is a search for a safe emotional connection. And when we find that, when we feel like our partner is there for us, is accepting us unconditionally, valuing us, treasuring us, hearing us, seeing us, understanding us, when we feel felt in that place, that's where we thrive. That's where we become our most resilient, our most creative. We do the best in that place. The problem is, and that's what we call love. That's what we say creates, those are the conditions for a loving, intimate relationship. The problem is no relationship can ever be that way all the time. And so there are times where we're not sure our partner is there for us, where we don't feel valued. We don't feel seen or heard or understood or appreciated and all those things. And that's the essence of conflict, according to attachment science. And so the goal of emotionally focused therapy is to create or recreate that sense of safety. Help couples show up for one another and honor, be there for each other on an emotional level. And for my money, that requires two things. So we're trying to help couples change their conversation along two lines, vulnerability and empathy. Those are hard to do in the midst of conflict. And so we help couples begin to understand what is going on when we get to these cycles of disconnection and anger, resentment, isolation, distancing. What's going on there? We begin to de-escalate that. We begin to kind of decriminalize it. And then we begin to help couples take those risks. And both processes, vulnerability and empathy, both are risky. And I have been amazed at how some of your other podcast guests have echoed these things. There's so much overlap in this community of wellness and striving for one's potential. You had Dr. Taryn Marie last October, the author of that book, Five Practices of Highly Resilient People.
That's right. Yep.
And she named those five practices, and the first one was vulnerability.
That's exactly
another
right.
Of those five was connectedness. And the key to connectedness is empathy. You can't connect with somebody if you can't get up in the tree beside them and see what they see from the perspective they're seeing it. It's hard to do. It's hard to be vulnerable. Everything in us says don't do that. And I loved what she said in her podcast. She talked about the three L's, the reasons that we don't open up. And it's hard to be vulnerable is because, number one, we're convinced that people won't like me. Number two, we're convinced they won't love me. And number three, we're certain that they will leave me. And from attachment science, to be left, to be abandoned, to be cut off, to be rejected, is, emotionally speaking, is death. And so we do anything to avoid those things. And so in our workshops and in the therapy that we do, we point people toward a different kind of conversation, not confrontation, but conversation, to point people towards vulnerability and understanding that's where we connect, and help people to be empathic with their partner. And we don't push people to that, but we do point them in that direction, and we let people take their own, go at their own pace. You had another guest just last month, Sonika Street.
Yes, yes.
We're talking about molding true masculinity.
That's right.
And he said something that really caught my attention. He said, the job of the masculine is to create trust and safety. And I equate trust and safety. And I'm saying, yeah, that's where relationships have to go.
Yes.
A relationship that doesn't have safety is in distress. So I don't know if I evaded your question adequately, Alex, but the goal that I try to bring people to in our work, whether it be in a workshop or in therapy, is vulnerability and empathy. Those two things will absolutely change the game. It will change the conversation. At the end of the day, we're just trying to help people have a different kind of conversation that doesn't have to escalate and end up alienating people that love each other dearly.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Hold Me Tight workshop, because that's obviously how I came in contact with you. And that's where I experienced this very powerful and transformational space that was created with all these different conversations and such that couples were having with each other. And they were in all sorts of different stages of relationship. There was couples there that were looking to polish their relationship up and refine things. And then there were couples there that was like a last ditch effort. And what I'm curious about is, from your perspective, can you tell me how the structure and the format of the workshop differ from other, you know, couple therapy sessions or workshop that you've either participated in or facilitated before?
Sure. So for anyone who might be interested in one of these workshops, I can tell you that it's not therapy. Okay. And nobody's ever died in one of our workshops. It truly can be an intimidating prospect, you know. On the first day, you know, people are always a little bit guarded. They're not sure what to expect. And it takes a certain amount of courage to try something new. But I really do want to ease people's minds. We go, no two couples are the same. And as you said, couples come to us at different stages and statuses. And we take all comers, you know, living together, married, separated. We've had couples that are separated at the time, gay, straight, non-binary, whatever. We require it to be couples in a committed relationship, or couples that want to be in a committed relationship. And the thing that's different about it for me is that it is both educational, we learn a lot, but it's also experiential. We allow couples to have time together to have conversations that gradually and incrementally increase the vulnerability and the empathy. And we let couples go at their own pace. If a couple says, you know, this is too hot to touch for us, we really think probably not ready for that, we say, okay. We don't give a test at the end. Nobody earns a certificate. It's not a certification. And what we say is, we give people a roadmap. It can be so helpful if you're lost on a journey just to get a map. You may still be 1,000 miles from where you want to go, but now you know how to get there. And that can be a game changer. And so the workshop is based on the book by Dr. Sue Johnson entitled Hold Me Tight. That's why we call it Hold Me Tight Workshop. The book is the sort of the template for the workshop. More is in the book than is in the workshop, but we use it as a template. And we have, over the course of the 2 days, we allow couples to have 6 different conversations. Each one ventures a little bit further out into deeper water. And by the end of the second day, couples, some of them have had conversations they never knew they could have, never knew they needed to have, and are amazed at what vulnerability and empathy can do in a relationship. But as we do it slowly and gradually, we're creating the safety to give people the opportunity to do that vulnerable, empathic conversation.
Hmm. Well, having experienced it, I can tell you, you know, firsthand that the conversations do get more and more impactful and require vulnerability. And what I experienced was coming out of those conversations, you start to find a different perspective and a different connectedness to your partner and see them outside of whatever lens you may have placed on them prior. So what would you say are some key communication skills, I guess you could call them, or you could call them tactics maybe, that you can encourage couples to develop? And I think as importantly, how can you support them to practice and refine those over time?
Right. That's a good question. I don't do a lot of skills building in terms of, you know, you say it this way, you say it that way. But I do encourage people to have a different frame of mind in the conversations that they have. When couples are in distress and they're really armored up, there's a lot of defenses, and we talk about those things. We talk about how that happens and why it makes sense. Love makes exquisite sense. It's not mystical or mythical. It's not random. Love is a survival code. It makes exquisite sense. And we are working in the workshop and in the therapy that we do to help couples create safety with each other and de-escalate that negative cycle that they get into. And so one of the things that I say to couples quite often is that when you're in a situation where you have this potential problem conversation that you're afraid could become a confrontation, and you don't know exactly how to handle it, you have two options in that moment. You can either be critical with your partner, or you can be curious. Critical means, why did you do that? Or I hate it when you do that. Or you always do this, or you never do that. And we are blaming, pushing our partner's buttons. We're creating a sort of a courtroom scene where we're litigating why our partner's wrong and why we're right. If they just do it our way, everything would be okay. And partners very quickly begin butting heads. Curious is a different way of being. Curious is about saying, you know, I don't know what happened there, but I'm wondering how what I just said landed on you. Or I'd really like to know, this seems really important to you and I can feel the passion. So what's up? Help me understand this. And it's not in a defensive or an accusing way. It's truly curious. Help me understand. Hmm. When we listen to our partner, listen to learn. Don't listen to debate or create your rebuttal, but listen to learn and see if you can understand where your partner's coming from. That's empathy.
Hmm.
It simply is about seeing it from your partner's point of view. The minute we become critical, the minute we try to change their mind, the minute we try to debate, the temperature in the room changes, and we've all felt it. And so I encourage partners to try to be curious rather than critical, and I promise it'll change the direction of the conversation.
Wow. Those are just so pragmatic. So you have a choice. You choose to be critical or you choose to be curious. And in that choice, there's a way of being and there are ways you show up as curious.
But in our workshop, we help people understand there's stuff going on under the surface through all of that, that it's important to slow down and begin to understand. Okay, we all have a sort of an inner world. Letting our partner see is about vulnerability.
Mm.
We don't always show it because sometimes we don't even know it. We have to slow it down and begin to make sense of that. And that's part of what we do in the workshop, to help people make sense of their inner world enough for them to be able to let their partner in to that. So we use three words to measure healthy attachment. Okay, and we're always sort of aiming our couples in that direction. And those three words are accessible, responsive, and engaged. Accessible and responsive is about showing up for your partner with curiosity and openness and empathy. Engaged is about opening up and letting your partner in so they can be empathic and sensitive and open with you. Accessible, responsive, engaged, ARE. Those are sort of the benchmarks for healthy attachment. And that's what we're hoping to help couples aim for and move towards in our workshops.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was powerful for me. And one thing that I'm hearing now is it really is both parties involved. The couple does this together. It doesn't work if one person is in this work. It really does have to be both. And identifying themselves and establishing them as a couple and working together is powerful. And, you know, just couples that are willing to put themselves out there and do this work, that alone really shows something. It really takes something to improve sometimes some of the closest relationships to you, which is your romantic partner. So really great work. I'm wondering, after a workshop, how would those that, you know, learn these tools and, as you said, have that roadmap, and, you know, they leave the workshop and suddenly there's a bump along the way on the roadmap, which inevitably happens, right? There's a there's a roadblock where you didn't expect it, right? What do you suggest to couples, or how do you support couples that are now having this new insight, this new roadmap, and are finding themselves stuck again?
Okay. There's several different options. We worked very hard to provide a workbook for our couples. So they use the exercises that are in it, and those exercises are never one and done, okay? And so what we're trying to do in a workshop is to give couples some real life experience and practice at having these what we call bonding conversations, where they are deeply vulnerable and deeply empathic. And those conversations, they don't need to happen every day. You just need to know that you can have them when you need to. When you're feeling that disconnection, when you're not sure what the heck is going on, so that you can reach to your partner with an open hand instead of a fist, figuratively speaking, you can have a different kind of conversation. When couples get to a place where they know that even when they're hurting, they can turn to their partner and find support and presence and responsiveness, accessible, responsive, engaged, they've got it made. Now, every couple will hit bumps after a workshop. I can guarantee it. The question is not, did we hit a bump? The question is, do we know how to repair? That's one of the things Gottman tells us. It's, strangely enough, healthy couples, unhealthy couples, masters of relationships and disasters of relationships conflict at the same rate and over the same issues. The difference between the two is the ability to repair, to become a pair again, to repair,
that,
to turn toward each other, to reach to each other, okay? And so one solution or one thing that a couple can do when they hit a bump is go back and look over what you learned in that workshop, okay? Another thing that they can do, some couples come to our workshop having already read Hold Me Tight. Others say, I'm getting it as soon as I leave. But that book can be really reinforcing, really helpful. And a third thing, if couples find themselves continually, we just can't get out of our own way, we seem to get stuck, and usually it's over a particular issue, I don't know, money, sex, religion, in-laws, children, those are the big five. If couples find themselves really stuck in a place where they just keep getting hung up here, that's when I would say, find an EFT therapist and sit down and unpack this. And having learned what you learn in a Hold Me Tight workshop, believe me, you'll be on a fast track to begin to make some sense of it. And sometimes, I don't know why it is, but couples that go tooth and nail at home over the kitchen table act very differently with a neutral third party in a setting like a therapist's office, and can converse about it instead of conflict over it. And that can just be a different dynamic. And so that is always an option to sit down with an EFT therapist.
This sounds like very supportive, groundbreaking work. I want to commend you and I want to celebrate you for taking on this work. I am curious in terms of how you feel that EFT could relate to other relationships in terms of possibly non-romantic relationships, parental relationships or relationships with kids or groups or employees or things like that.
Absolutely.
Where do you see this work
being
able to make an impact there?
Well, there is a field of therapy called emotionally focused family therapy that does include, you know, nuclear family, larger group. And so, you know, if you're talking about the essentials of creating safety, of vulnerability and empathy, unpacking things, slowing it down, owning what's going on, this can apply in all kinds of different domains. Vicky and I are exploring the possibilities of approaching businesses that have a sort of a proactive stance to help improve communication in the workplace, or simply help employees improve their intimate relationships, because happy, emotionally and mentally healthy employees are more productive. They stay longer. They get more done. I don't mean stay longer hours during the day. I mean stay there at that company longer. Hmm. It's a well worthwhile investment. Another dimension of this, but I focus primarily on intimate relationships because that's where the stakes are highest. It will apply in a lot of other settings for sure.
Hmm.
But I find that, you know, my hands are full just working with couples. When the stakes are highest, that's when we go to our reactive positions faster, farther, stay there longer, right?
Yeah. Well, it is so true.
So I, that's sort of...
Yeah, it's so true that vulnerability, compassion, empathy, all of that translates to all relationships across the board, whether you're talking about children, parents, coworkers, bosses, employees, people around you every day. When you communicate with them in that way, connections are formed. And thank you for just bringing this insight. Such valuable information that you've given as a gift to our audience today. Thank you so much for giving this. If people are interested and they want to learn more, or they want to take part in the Hold Me Tight workshop that you and Vicky hold, how can they find out more about you?
Great. Thank you for asking. We have a website. It is www.couplesworkshopsofflorida.com. Couples Workshops of Florida, all one word, no punctuation in there, .com. And we do 4 workshops a year. Our next one is April 28th and 29th, so about a month from now. We do them in Winter Park, Florida, which is a suburb of Orlando. Orlando has more hotel rooms per capita than any city in the world, with all of these attractions and so forth. We do Friday and Saturday. And a lot of couples stay and, make it a long weekend and go see some sights. So it's a great place to come to. And all the information is on our website. Thanks for letting me do that little plug.
Oh, absolutely. Well, if you're in Florida and you're near Orlando, it's absolutely recommended, no matter what stage you are in a relationship. Come to Orlando for something outside of Disney, or maybe add Disney to the tail end or the beginning of your trip to Orlando. But the Hold Me Tight workshop is something that I've experienced, transformed my relatedness and my connectivity, and really gave me tools that I could use in my romantic relationship. And for those that are looking to always improve or looking to repair the closest relationship that most people have to them, it's such an honor to have someone and have this work and have someone who's just so deeply passionate about this work and who's just supporting the community in this way. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Mark.
Alex, it's a real honor. I tell you, as I look over the community of people that you've gathered for your podcasts and so forth, I'm just excited and very grateful to be a part of that. So thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a pleasure having you. And I'm looking forward to you doing so much more, having so much more impact and giving couples access to this sort of work. So appreciate you being on the show.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.